Tonight starts is the first class of a series of eight classes on the four illusions. The four illusions, and I just want to talk about them a little bit, and then I'll go into the first one. But some of you who have been on retreat know the symptoms of the early part of a retreat, which is that there's a lot of mind activity and a lot of revulsion and resistance to that activity of the mind and body as it begins to relax, as we begin to release the holds of how we have held the tension of our life. Things come up. Emotions arise. Memories occur. Thoughts can get compounded. And there's an enormous amount of tension with each of those as the screens of the mind orient themselves in a proper relationship to the practice. And you can get a sense of this a resistance that we carry with us on an ongoing basis, just having gone through a single day of a retreat and feeling the problematic situations that arise continuously throughout the day. Those are not just occurring on retreat. Those are almost a continuous pattern of how we live our lives, and that we are now being quiet enough so that we can see how we live our life, and that's the definition of a retreat. But what happens is that eventually, because of how the retreat is framed, and because there's nothing else you can do with these mental waves except to release them. And of course, that's in accordance with how the retreat is being taught. So eventually, this pattern of conflict and resistance ebbs and flows out. And there's this potential serenity, quiet, that flows in. And it's not that the retreat then becomes automatic and comfortable from then on, but that first wave is the first defenses, the breaching of our first sense of defenses. And once those defenses are breached, then the mind begins to release instead of just contain and contract around each and every emotion or attitude that it holds, but begins to release it, then those defenses are really become perforated, and energetically things can come in and flow out in a very kind of organic, natural way. And we find ourselves within that organic, natural flow of emotions arising, but being released as they arise rather than contained within the story and all of the constrictions that we put place upon what we're doing and how we're doing it. When that's surrendered, this beautiful sense of harmony begins to be sensed. We begin to sense harmony that we perhaps have never touched. And I believe that's what Christ meant in its deepest form by the peace that passeth all understanding. And we begin to see through our defenses instead of being just reflecting our defenses reflecting back in projection, what they see and what they interpret. We begin to see through those defenses as we quiet, as we align ourselves with life. And what is seen is a life, a dimension, a reality that is very, very different, not in terms of what we see, but what we make out of what we see. What we think about what we see, our reactions to what we see, feel, smell, taste, touch. And we get a sense, insightfully, that we have been living our life in a completely discordant way, not in accordance to truth, but in accordance to the mind's interpretation of that truth, which has thrown us way off base. And in fact, the eruption of that defensiveness in the early phases of a retreat was going through the counterfeit way that the mind has interpreted truth. And that's why it was so tense and tight and contracted. And what we begin to perceive is a very different dimension of reality. Now, this series has to do with the perception of reality after our defenses have been breached. And it starts with how reality looks when our defenses are fully in place and firmly in control. And the Buddha called these views completely inverted views. The view that we hold of reality, the views that we hold of reality with our defenses in place, are completely inverted and contradictory to the truth of the way things actually are. They are misperceptions, ultimately driven by our motivations and actions. They drive everything. They drive our attitudes. They drive our disposition, our posture. They drive everything about our life. And yet they're completely false. Now that should get your attention. Right? So now we've just finished with this long series on the oxes, ox herding pictures. And many of you escaped as far as you could from that series. Some of you appreciate it, which is fine. But this is a series where everyone, if you're going to be in this tradition, needs to show up, for God's sake. Because this is the basis of the teaching. If we're not interested in how we're corrupting and distorting reality, well, what are we doing here? Because meditation isn't about just finding a moment of serenity or a moment of peace and then kind of warming our bodies around that particular glow, because that glow will pass. That glow is not something that we can carry out much longer than we can our daily sitting. But it's really about perceiving reality, perceiving what all of this is in its true and natural relationship to things. And I think I can present this so that it's comfortably within everyone, even the very beginner's level of understanding. And hopefully I can stretch those of you who are here for the X number of years into that as well. That's always the stress I'm under in a talk, is to make it applicable to people who are new and also rich to those who have been here a long time. So these inverted views takes a critical aspect of reality to be precisely what it is not. And these views are the world as lived through the mind. So I'm just reframing them. The Buddha talks about them as inverted views. I'm talking about them as views lived through the mind. Once the mind gets a hold of reality, it creates an abstract way of perceiving that reality. Instead of living in accordance with reality, it brings a conceptual overlay to that reality and then lives in accordance with those concepts. I'm not going to go into that extensively on in this series, but it's important to have that understanding that when I'm talking about living through the mind, I mean living through the abstract, living through thought, the thought about things rather than the real nature of those things that we are thinking about. And thought can make anything out of anything. It can distort, change, modify, add, subtract, multiply anything about anything, because it's all internal. It's what it thinks about the world. And that's very dangerous, to rely upon what we think about the world to be what the world is. We really know what other people think about us, don't we? Or we really know what we are about, don't we? And who we are. So I want to look at these inverted views, and I just want to mention all four of them, and then we'll go to the first one. But they're really optical illusions of reality. Optical illusions. So what are these four illusions? One, the first, taking what is impermanent to be permanent. Right? So I just want to give you a nibble. Right? And then we'll talk a little bit. Taking what is impermanent to be permanent. And concepts do just that, don't they? Concepts, when they lay hold of something, don't allow that thing to have a reality in and of itself. It becomes a word, and that word and the meaning of that, the thing itself becomes the meaning the word gives it. And the word doesn't really change. The concept doesn't hold the life of the thing itself. It holds the mental abstraction of that. So I just want to reinforce that. The second illusion that I'll talk about in a couple of weeks is taking what is inherently incapable of satisfying as satisfying. When we create a world of concepts and optical delusions of reality, then we're going to be chasing after the world in a very different way than the world will ever be able to feed us. And it'll lead to a consummate disappointment and unhappiness in relationship to how we're trying to be fed, but it's incapable of feeding us in that way. And then the third inverted reality is taking the momentary display of the world as being continuous. This. Is all there is. This has no past, has no future, is only and can only be itself. And but what the mind makes of it is a continuous theme of this having come from something, as a derivation. This is a derivation from something and is evolving towards something. And then the fourth inverted view, which is will be the last talk I give, is taking what inherently lacks independent existence as independently existing. That's you and me, thinking that we are separate from. So that is how most of us live our lives. All four of those, compounded by the invested energy we give them, is how we live our life. It's called our life. It's called how we try to derive fulfillment from our life, how we hide and deny from certain truths about our life, how we take up a stance of isolation in regards to life, and how we place the whole thing under a continuous theme of something that has no bearing or reality to anything. And that's called our life. And so we're really looking in these 8 weeks together about our derivation of our life, the derivation of our life. Extremely important. I would hope that you would feel that too. And each of these inverted views are really holograms of one or the other. You can take one. And in its profoundest understanding, all four of them will be revealed within the one. Like any truth. You know, I've given so many talks, starting out in left field and ending up in right field. Because all the fields come together in center field. And so, no matter where you start this thing, there's only one place you can end up if you go to depth, if you go with depth through it. So, hopefully in each talk we'll get a sense of what the center field looks like from each of these points of reference that these talks have. And what's very important is that we have to take our lives seriously, and we have to take our difficulties seriously, and we can't blame those difficulties upon circumstances, or we won't look at the reality of what the inherent reality of something will blame it on the circumstances that has imparted that reality. You see? You know, if you have a relationship with someone and after 30 years the person dies and you blame the doctor for not seeing the tumor, you're missing the truth that everybody dies. You see how that works? And so you think that it was your fault that they died, or the doctor's fault, or God's fault, or somebody's fault, when the truth is that everybody dies, period. That's the truth. And so if we keep blaming circumstantially on the problems of life, we won't look at the laws that govern those problems. You see? And it's very important to understand that. And many of us are so susceptible to self-blame that we're not blaming other people, we're blaming ourselves. I wasn't up to it, I should have tried harder. Because we carry a kind of self-inadequacy that I've talked about many, many times, which sets us up for self-disappointment and self-discouragement. And that's no good either. We have to look at the laws of life. We have to see how we're contradicting these very laws of life. Well, we're screwing things up mentally. We're getting it wrong. And if we want to see reality as it is, what's it look like when it's not all covered up with my best wishes for things, my imaginative and fantasy response for things? What's it look like underneath the veil? I can remember early on in my practice standing in front of the mirror and just wanting to tear my chest open to see what's inside this thing, because I felt so pretentious in every form and expression. What was it? And I think it takes a kind of passion like that. Not, if you're just looking for this practice to be self-serving, it will be, because you'll make of it what your intentions are for it, and your life will be a little more adjusted. You'll be more content, but you won't have touched the depth of what you could touch if your intentions were a little more authentic and deeper. So the Buddha said, it was interesting, when he's talking about these inverted views, he says, this is willful ignorance. He says, you're doing this deliberately to yourself. I like that. He doesn't let us out of it. The constant... It's not just not knowing, but not wanting to know, he said. It's not just I'm ignorant, I haven't been told about it. No, we're deliberately not looking at it because we don't want to see it. Ignore it, ants. It's like this Wall Street debacle we have at the moment, right? I was reading in the New York Times about the Lehman Brothers, and that they have known, everybody has known, the whole company knew that the true worth of their securities, but they were just pretending. They denied. They just weren't going to own it. They just couldn't let that into their reality. So this happened. It's interesting, isn't it? How strong that sense of denial is in us. I have heard, and actually have met people who have been in disasters. Like the person I'm referring to was in a boating disaster, and she was in a storm or something happened. But anyway, the boat was completely wrecked. Nobody around. She and about three or four other people on this boat that was just devastated. I think it was a sailing boat in it. All the masks were broken. Everything couldn't sail. And they just went around for days in a haze, in a denial haze, just trying to go about the typical life patterns, denying what had occurred and the severity of the situation they were in. And I think many of us have been in that, where perhaps a disastrous hit that's so devastating, it throws us so off, out of sync to the reality we want to live in, desperately yearn to live within, that we don't know what to do with this new orientation. And so I really don't believe, and maybe I'm being naive, that this Lehman Brothers was a malicious institution. I mean, it's 185 years of doing what they've been doing. They went through the Great Depression and all. Now what happened here, you see? It's just denial. It's the same denial that we would have when we feel that funny lump, but you know it's nothing, right? Anyway, I have a doctor's appointment in 6 months. I'll talk to him about it. It's a denial that we as a culture have that protects us from the mysterious. Have you noticed how we protect ourselves from the mysterious? We call it coincidence or chance. I mean, there's amazing things that we don't put them in because they don't fit the parameters of what we believe. So if they don't fit the parameters of what we believe, they don't get included in our history or even in our concepts. I heard it to a story that when the Indians in the West Indies, when the Columbus's first ship sailed close to the shores, the Indians had no way of being able to perceive a ship as such, so they just didn't see it. They couldn't see it. And then supposedly a shaman who could see it trained them to see it. Because it wasn't within the dimensions of their understanding. Or it was so far outside of what it meant to their life that the denial and defensiveness was so steadfast, they wouldn't let it in. So now I'm speaking to you about the Buddha's truth, okay? We're talking of Columbus's ship at 1 on the scale, and we're talking about 100 on the scale being the Buddha's truth. This is not something most of us let in very easily, because it shakes the apple cart. This is about the governing ways that we live. Our orientation to life, the purpose we give life, the intentions we have for life, the value we offer to life, the purpose we think we have within life. You want to go there? Most of us want to head for the exits. So we do this in a graduated form. We do this as a way that can make it palatable. Fair enough. We have to. That's why we keep meeting on the same themes every single week. Really. Just one taste. There's only one taste to any of this. The same taste. But it's important to hear it again and again and to keep moving and edging closer. Because just like we do on the first day of a retreat, or we begin to adapt, we begin to see, we begin to have insight, we begin to perceive. And that orientation has its benefits. It's not all hell. You know, once we perceive it and we allow ourselves to actually get in line with the truth and actually perceive it, let it in and integrate it, something good happens. I mean, why would anybody do this if it was just going to move us into a greater hell or more fear? There's something... You know, it does get better. Okay, so what is this first truth? This first truth, the first of these illusions, the illusion of permanence. See, the Buddha began his journey from that realization. He goes out from his castle walls, he sees change. He sees somebody dying, somebody getting old, he sees sickness instead of health. He says, geez, life isn't all happy-go-lucky. And he was extremely protected 29-year-old. And he has this realization. It's his first insight, really. He goes, gee, life isn't consistent. It's not a guarantee. I can't invest my hopes into it. See, this is the implication. But I have, he said, you know, God, this throws everything off. I've got a son, beautiful wife. I'm a prince, castle, subjects, money. So what does he do? He sneaks out at night and he leaves all of that. It's metaphor. It's a metaphor. Because we're stuck within our castle walls, which is called 21st century America. It just happens to be the best the world is ever going to offer because we don't have access to the same resources in the future. So this is it. And yet all around us things are crumbling and movement is afoot. And we're trying to shore everything up. And our financial markets are crumbling. And our levies are breaking, literally and figuratively. And the seas are coming in. And we don't know what to do. And so we're kind of just, everybody's saying, you don't have to worry. You read that. Nothing to worry about. Temperatures altering. Ice caps melting. Polar bears unable to land. Don't worry. Are we shipwrecked? Have we just been through some kind of devastating storm and we don't even have an orientation here? Are we in denial here? What is it that the world is trying to tell us? What is it not, how can I make this thing last for the next generation or so, but what is the world trying to say to us? What's all this happening? It's not hell and damnation. It's not saying you've been a sinner. That's what some people think it's saying. That's not what I think it's saying. I think it's saying no guarantees. No promises here. You started off with one life and you may have to live a completely dramatically different life. Or be dead. But consistency is not going to be it. And if we actually let that information in for a moment, we realize that we have known that all along. It's not a truth that comes crashing in with like a completely unknown expectation. This is known to us. In fact, you could go out on the street and ask almost anyone if they realized change and permanence, and they'd say, of course. But what are they doing with that concept? They're keeping it external. We're keeping it external to ourselves as a concept rather than as a living reality. We haven't ventured outside our castle walls and actually seen the corpse. We've looked at it in an anatomy book, or we've heard about it on TV. What's it look like up close? It looks like dikes breaking. It looks like lumps on breasts. That's what it looks like. It looks like financial markets crumbling. Climate's changing. Now what? Because if we rest with the need for continuance, for permanency, for consistency, for guarantees, we're going to be in trouble. Is there another way? And can we realize that way? Because that's the Buddha's message. Everyone can understand the concept of change. How many of us are willing to integrate that into the very fabric of our being so that we know everything is in motion? There is nothing, nothing. And wherever we lay claim that there is something, that's where we need to go, because there is nothing, not one thing, that does not change and is in constant movement. Every cell of the body, every neuron of the mind, every expression of thought, every embodiment of emotion. Virtually the entire sense of self and other is in a fluidity, a movement, a dance. No static, no steadiness, no reliance. And now we start getting afraid. We start backing away. Why did I ever come tonight? Could have missed another one. You see, because that's the first reaction is the reaction of the defenses. Remember, we're on day one of a retreat, first hour of retreat. Mind's coming at you. It's where everybody's packing their bags mentally to find their escape route. I'm out of here. Like, I can duck out at noon. Nobody will ever miss me. But I'm asking you to stay. I'm asking you to sit in this together. We can't keep moving from it. We can't keep denying this thing. And I've made it very dramatic. But if you just look at your body, you'll see the absolute truth as expressed moment after moment of impermanence. I love this. I rarely read anything, but I love this. This is from Gayo Shihi, called Passages. With each passage, some magic must be given up, some cherished illusion of safety and comfortably familiar sense of self must be cast off to allow for the greater expansion of our own distinctiveness. Times of crisis, of disruption, or constructive change are not only predictable, but desirable. They mean growth. Because the blow of a life accident hits harder if it coincides with a critical passage in the life cycle, it may force us to resolve the issues of that passage more effectively. They're not only desirable, that they are our salvation. We have to realize that reality is ultimately our only salvation. That our mind's interpretation of reality can only be lived at the expense of our own pain, discouragement, disappointment. And that the more we come in alignment to the reality and the laws of that reality, we have to have some faith, and for some it's not quite there, that will mean a difference in how we will live, the harmony of our own life, the adaptability and fluidity of our own life, the accommodation, the ability to surrender, to let go, to release, to see with wisdom, rather than through the reflective gaze of the mind's interpretation. We try so hard to continue ourselves, to make ourselves move forward. But shouldn't we first know what we are and whether we are this thing that can move forward in lockstep? Before we have the expectation of going somewhere? What is it that we're trying to move? What does this thing look like when it's actually lived experientially? I can't find anything steady or consistent about it. And perhaps the more we start aligning ourselves into the verb of life, which is all things are verbs, the more we'll stop trying to be defensive into protecting the noun of who I think I am. So that I don't have to try to be guarded. If I'm in movement, and if the way I move is because of the influences that external reality has on me, that I have to accommodate those things, and that's the way I grow. Doesn't that make sense? That as reality is moving in multiple ways, and I adapt to those multiple ways that it is moving, that's called my growth. And if I freeze a particular resistance to the way reality is moving, I'm going to be in crash status to that particular quality of reality, right? And that's called pain. So the more fluid I am in being able to meet the fluidity of life as it's evolving, the more harmony and happiness and joy I'll have within life itself. And that is what the whole of the teaching is meant to do. But we've got to get your attention. It's trying to shake you just enough so that you'll look around and ask relevant questions to see whether we are doing that or whether we're pretending to try to do that. And many of us are very good at using change as a way to pretend to try to do that. I'll give you an example. You're in a difficult situation, and so you say, oh, this too shall pass. That is a defense mechanism. That's not realization. Yes, it's true, it will, but you're trying to survive the difficulty that's at hand by giving yourself a new concept rather than to show up for the actual fact of what your life is doing. Wisdom, once seen, can then be used as a defense and an actual obstruction to further growth. Because we all know change. I mean, if you got into this thing through any classes I've taught, or anybody in this tradition, that's probably the first word that came out of their mouth, impermanence. And we all think we know so much about it, don't we? Well, that one again. If I'd known it had been about that, I would have stayed home. But do we really, you see? Because realization is very different than conceptualization. Realization takes you to your mortality. It's a difference between knowing you're going to die and knowing you're going to die. Has that hit you yet? Jeez. It hits you like a blow. I mean, since day one, when you first learned words, quite likely you knew you were going to die at some point, by age 7 anyway. But maybe it's age 70 that it's actually... That's what fascinated me, is that I wanted to know. I wanted to know that. I wanted to know what I was missing here, because I was missing it. I knew I hadn't had the realization, so I went to the bedside of the dying, and I wanted to see up close, get myself as close as I could, and maybe some of it would rub off. And it did. It did. And it's not pleasant. It's not a pleasant realization. It's like a house of cards just comes apart. You know, somebody pulls one of these elaborate sand castles or something, and a wave hits it, and suddenly it's just all kind of round. It used to be a castle, now it's just kind of rounded sand. That's what it feels like. And we're very good at adapting along the way. We use each occasion for wisdom, each occasion to understand, like, now I know, now I know. Now I know how. And as we get older, adaptation is harder. Guilty. It's harder. Because the mind gets more encrusted in its ways. There's just no other way of saying it. You think you know. You know, I've been brought to my knees in humility. And I'm not talking about months, I'm talking about days ago, where I just, oh my God, I'm so far off, I cannot believe I'm this far off. And sometimes I don't want to admit it. You know that one? You just don't want to go back and have to do that again. You know, you'd rather keep the projection out there that you're somehow beyond all that. And it exposes the fragility of everything, really. It exposes the fragility of my certainty. And that's good, because the more certain we are, the further from the truth we are. Isn't that funny? And you know what? It takes you, it forces us to live loss. Forces us to live loss. Instead of trying to control loss, right? The story of life is discovered within the theme of loss. Do you know that? All the disappointments, all of the tragedies, all of the unhappiness, it's discovered, the truth is discovered within that, not in contrast to that, not in defense of that. Within that. And it just keeps coming. Every moment, when we become sensitive enough, we live within loss. And loss is the last thing that we want any part of. Because loss implies loss of everything. In fact, we create a heaven where loss is not part of it. We say, well, after we die, there will be no more loss. A safe haven from loss. That's what heaven is. And so this need to constantly project can become a cue that we are in the wrong alignment to reality. If I am hunkered down, and I'm so certain, and I'm so convinced, and I'm so defensive, and I'm unwilling to listen to someone else's feedback, well, you've become a Buddhist, but you haven't become a Buddha. It's asked much more for us than a new stance, a new projection, a new posture, a new attitude. It asks much more from us than that. It asks humility. And there isn't anything that's harder than humility for most of us. It asks patience. And this is not a society of patience. It asks surrender. And we're a society of control. It asks to live it rather than to be detached from it. To let it affect us. Because we begin to live change. We don't experience change. In the beginning, we experience change. But that's still me experiencing something outside of me. I am being protected from change as I experience change that is happening to my body or even to my thoughts, because there's a safe haven that I've created back there, which I am resistant to any aspect of change at all. That sense of, that's where we're held up. We hold up our life within, we've encircled the wagons right there. And now everything else is changing. No, we're asked, the Dharma asks us to live change. Change is me, is I, is the sense of I. The change is us. It's not survival, it's freedom. I am not apart from change. How many of us, when we meditate, look at the objects of change safely from a place that doesn't seem to be changing at all? So the practice is to make life a verb. And wherever we have created a fixed response or an absolute certainty or a resolution, that is where we're stuck. Or a disciplined approach. There is no one way to do everything. We just keep trying to muscle our way through life rather than to understand it, to become fluid with it. This is about melting the snowman, not freezing it for a further stance. Melting. We've got to melt our way into this thing. So with this, okay, I got it now. I'm not going to do this any longer. I'm not going to hold myself out any longer. I'm not going to do that. Come and get me. And you mean it. Not doing some child's game. You mean it. And then it starts working. And let's all work in that direction. Together. Because when we're working at this level of depth, together is a very fine way to work. It's hard enough for any one of us to do this. Doing it alone, well, that's not my way. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? So as we sit, hold nothing back. Give yourself over. Give yourself over to impermanence. See what it's like not to have a reference, not to have a stance, not to take a position, not to be in disagreement or agreement. Okay, if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to. The question is, with so many things occurring naturally and unnaturally in this culture and in this world, how can we be open to it and be aware, right? Well, just your willingness to be is the first step, so that you're not going to hide from anything. Right? Just to say, okay, I'm not going to put my head in the sand here, right? I just, especially in this political climate, I'm not going to put my head in the sand here. I'm going to be available. I'm going to read the paper, listen, stay in tune to it. As difficult as it is, I'll bear with those difficulties. Just open myself up to the actual situations that are occurring. And then at some point, the heart will feel almost overwhelmed in what it's taking in. And then, very consciously and with awareness, you can retreat a little. And you say, okay, I have time for a movie. Right? Time to just read junk books. But you know what you're doing all the time. So you say, okay, it's just too much. I'm getting overflow. It's overflowing. And then you go back into it. And you read some more, you just listen, you hear the tragedies of hurricanes and all of that. And you just hold it. So there's no denial going on. And doesn't mean there isn't retreating, which is, deliberately keeping the messages at bay so that you can heal in your own time. But then you come out again. You don't make that the course of your life, to just shut your ears and say, I don't have anything to do with any of that. Or to say it's all written in the Bible and all those people will go to hell and I'll be saved. You don't do it that way. Because we're one of those people. Right? And then your actions will come from your understanding of the issues and your heart's inclusive of those same issues. And there will be a response that comes. It may be in how you vote. Or it could be in terms of sending money to the Red Cross or something. Or it could be in terms of your actual one-to-one involvement with something. But each of us will have a role to play. Each of us has a role to play. In all events, if nothing more than just to be open to them. None of us are separated from those events, even by the thinnest screen. Everything is arising, all of us are arising from those events, moment after moment. It's incumbent on us to include those events within our understanding. And I don't mean you have to know the details of them. The pain of them is good enough. Yes.
I guess my question kind of follows that feeling of that emotionality. I'm going to bring my process of watching the political situation right now. I'm feeling like I'm trying to fill myself with the information and trying to be open to it. What I find is that I get stuck in a lot of emotion that makes me feel very angry.
Well, what do you do when it seems like it's too much? Too much is a mind interpretation. It is never the heart's too much. The heart, listen, because you have to know where you're coming from to realize what to do. When you say it's too much, it's a mental, you're trying to mentally hold it, and you're never going to be able to mentally hold it. Your heart can hold it, but your mind cannot. It just boggles, it's too much, right? So you have to start infusing yourself into the heart's way, not the mind's way. The mind holds antagonism and cause and enemies and deceit and revenge and anger, and that's going to be too much. The heart holds the pain of the situation and can forever open to that. In fact, finds joy in the center of that inclusivity. So, first of all, know which organ you're investing in. And then work to adjust the proportion of those organs. Yes?
Could you talk a little more about the joy in the center of the pain?
Talk a little bit more about the joy in the center of the pain. Some of us who have had a series of years where there's been a lot of trauma, a lot of deaths, a lot of grief, a lot of illness, may not have touched that joy. But there are others of you who have. And that even though the world can be kind of, it's not cooperating, right? You know that feeling that the day just isn't cooperating. But you've ceased the argument. What you've ceased is saying this should not be happening. When you cease this should not be happening, what takes its place is joy. Even though all that stuff continues to happen. That's what it means to arrive at joy. Now, I know there's a whole thing out there in the Dharma world, and you can get into the, you know, one Dharma teacher in particular is putting out these, you know, how to embody joy and all. But that's an attitude. I mean, yes, you can work to develop a joyful attitude so that you adjust your mental way of thinking towards something so that you don't fight it. But that is not the depth of freedom. The depth of freedom is that you're not fighting, period. And you don't need a recourse concept, another concept, to fight the one that's there so that you're better in line with it. That's not the way it works. The way it works is you don't fight with it, period. Have you ever had something that's been on your mind and then you forget it? That's what surrender feels like. I was trying to think, what does surrender feel like? I keep talking about letting go, letting be, putting your arms down, not fighting, not resisting. It's like you forget it. It's not there anymore. There's no resistance to it, so it doesn't come up. You know, you have this thing that you really want to do, and then you start walking out, and then you forget what... Well, at 60, you'll find that you'll have that. Maybe at your age, you don't. And then you can't remember what the hell you're doing, and you're in the middle of the yard, and you know you're out there to do something. And it's like no idea what you're supposed to be doing. And so that's it. That's what surrender is. I said, well, that's it. I go back inside. That's what surrender feels like, right? It's not there anymore. So you're just not fighting. You just are not, it's not like I'm going to adjust this situation so that it works for me emotionally, so I can have a positive emotional response to it. You know, that's fine. That makes you nice people. But not free. But not free. Okay, we have a few announcements, so we're going to close this evening. Thank you all. Now, listen to everyone. We're going to do a discussion group next week on the homework. And there's a very important component to integrate these talks into our lives so that we have an ongoing access. Because it doesn't work just to come and listen to a talk and then go home and forget all about it until next talk. We've got to actually have some intentionality to use this, to spearhead it into our life. That's what the discussion and the homework is about. I really encourage the discussion, attendance to the discussion, to be a part of this series. All series, but this series in particular, because it's really looking at the very ways that we freeze and hold our resistance to life in inverted and completely contradictory ways.